I'm very happy now to welcome Winona LaDuke. She's a Native American activist, environmentalist, economist, and writer. She's the executive director of the organizations Honor the Earth and White Earth Land Recovery Project. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you are one of the people who's going to be testifying in front of the Environmental Improvement Board here in New Mexico in favor of a carbon cap. And one of the things that I found fascinating is that Ojibwe prophecies speak of a time when people will have a choice between two paths, the scorched earth path and the green path. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they refer to this as the time of the seventh fire, the time that we're in now. And these prophets came to our people a long time ago, and they, of course, talked about things ahead. And they said that, we would be these people who were cognizant. They call us the Ashki Anishinaabeg, and said that we would have awakened from a lot of trauma and a lot of a loss of consciousness. And these new people would have a choice between two paths ahead of us, and one would be well-worn but scorched, and the other would not be well-worn. It would be green, and it would be our choice upon which path to embark. And that was instructions for us as Anishinaabeg people, but that is also really instructions, and I think that it's really very emblematic or symbolic of where the United States is at. You're at this point where we've combusted ourselves to the edge of oblivion. We're looking at a 2-degree temperature rise. We've got, a fossil fuel-dependent economy without a plan B at all, pretty much. Just, to keep drilling for it where we shouldn't be drilling for it, or combusting it when we shouldn't be combusting it. And we have the technology. We have the intellectual capital, or Europe does if we haven't capitalized it. And we have the financial resources plus the long-term financial mandate to make this transition. And so, we feel that it's very symbolic. And so the hearing that's being held this next week down in New Mexico that's been ongoing that I'm coming down for is very significant to all of us.
Is that what led you to begin studying climate change and its effect on Native people?
Well, an intersection between our traditional teachings and prophecies. I mean, I am a member of our Madewan Society. I do a lot of, our work in around this spiritual realm is significant. It's one of our main spiritual teachings up here. But more than that, perhaps, I have spent my whole life working on a lot of these issues. I live on this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful reservation full of lakes and wild rice and maple trees. And what you notice is, first I notice the coal plants and that I have mercury advisories out for most of the fishing lakes on my reservation. And that in itself is a problem, that we find that we are people who can't eat the fish because of there's mercury from coal-fired power plants that are upwind from us. So that's problem. That's huge problem for our community because we're low income in terms of money, our cash economy, but we are wealthy in terms of what the Creator gave us for fish and for deer and for food here, and it's a good life we were given. So we look at it from that terms, and then we notice that some things are changing here, not as rapidly as in other places. But I believe that no, not just a corporation, but one entity doesn't have a right for the purpose of profits and lack of visionary thinking or just laziness to transform ecosystems from lush ecosystems to ecosystems that are hit by torrential rains, windstorms, drought, chaotic hailstorms. And that's what we're beginning to see up here.
Tell us some of the ways in which climate change disproportionately affects Native people and low-income communities. I mean, the issue of environmental justice is incredibly strong, not only in things like coal-fired power plants and so on, but climate change.
Well, to begin with, I mean, climate change is leveling. Everybody is affected by it. If you're rich or you're poor, it does not matter. But the thing is that indigenous people, by and large, are living in these places where we have either been driven were we retained because they were remote. So, for instance, the Pacific. A good portion of the people who live on islands in the Pacific region are indigenous peoples, and their islands are going under. So if you look at Mother Jones a few issues ago, Tuvalu, looking for a new country because their island is going underwater. Kivalina, Shishmaref, a couple of Alaskan Native villages up in Alaska are falling into the ocean because of dramatic climate change. Greenland just lost this huge glacier. Majority population of Greenland is Inuit people. And so you have people who are in these remote or these Pacific or, you know, these Pacific-based areas that are heavily impacted by climate change already. Then you add to that the people that are looking at drought on a worldwide scale or torrential storms in quite often war-torn countries, you know, who find that not only are they afflicted by the trauma of intergenerational warfare, but now on top of that they have increasing loss of habitat, loss of ability to produce their food. And so on a worldwide scale, the people who are more disproportionately affected are poor people, indigenous people, people of war-torn areas. And so those people who are living in Albuquerque or Phoenix in some climate-controlled environment, it's such a strange concept to me, climate-controlled environment. There's a perception that climate change isn't really a problem. You're going from your air-conditioned house to your air-conditioned car. But in the meantime, the amount of energy required to keep that at a comfortable level is increasing, and the impact of the energy that is used to keep some kind of control over your personal bubble is increasing. And that is what's causing the problems to begin to spiral in the broader world. So the privilege of living in a bubble may be yours for now. But the reality is that over the long term, we're projecting, I mean, first of all, that they called them the death maps. They came out on USA Today. And Albuquerque area, New Mexico, Great Plains area, hardest hit areas are people who live in trailers or in the Great Plains because of severe weather conditions, you know, more at risk from these issues of climate change. And then people who are, you know, issues like diseases that travel are more likely to travel in a time of global climate transformation or global climate change. And then we will begin looking at the impact upon states and countries. They're projecting that by the year 2020, that 20% of world GDP will be spent on climate change-related impact already. That's on a worldwide scale, and that's coming out of British studies. State of New Mexico, $3.2 billion annually minimum costs, $6.3 billion by 2040, and if we make it and haven't baked ourselves into oblivion by 2080, $18.4 billion annually. That's what we're looking at with the impact on our economy. And so, you know, it's kind of like fix it now, do the right thing now, or just try to scramble later and see what we can live with.
We're talking to Native American activist, environmentalist, and economist Winona LaDuc. The thing you said a moment ago about people feeling that it's their right to live in a personal bubble, that really bespeaks a whole mentality that one house is not connected to the next house, one family to the next family, one town to the next town, rather than the more accurate reality that we are all connected via our ecosystem. So there's a real kind of thought transformation that needs to happen.
No, that's right. And I feel like that we don't want to be those people that perceive that we can live in a bubble, because you know what? That's just not healthy. You know,
right.
Not only is it lonely in the bubble, you know, if you spend all your time in a bubble colliding with other bubbles and interacting in your climate-controlled world, but, you know, in addition to that, you become somebody who no longer is a part of the creation and the natural world that the Creator gave us. You know, and so we have a beautiful, beautiful opportunity here to do the right thing in New Mexico. And everywhere, we have the beauty and the opportunity to keep our Mother Earth from combusting, to create a shot where, to ensure that there's an opportunity for our children and our grandchildren to grow food and provide for our own communities in a way that, you know, has some kind of food security. We have an opportunity to reduce the health impact of climate change, whether it is airborne contaminants, or the misery of dying from heat wave or desertification. We have the opportunity to save our economy from squandering and hemorrhaging its wealth to disasters which could have been prevented by some foresight and a denial of access to endless greed. That's who we are. We're the people that have the opportunity to do the right thing. And, you know, in New Mexico, that is the question that is being asked. Does anyone want to look out? Does anybody want to do the right thing? Does anyone want to transform an inefficient, coal-based energy economy to a solar and wind economy? Because the long-term economic benefits of relocalizing energy are immense. And the reality is first of all, if you pay for a solar economy or a wind economy, you can project the price of fuel into the future. In other words, you're not subject to the vagaries of a fossil fuel market, whether it is coal, natural gas, or oil. You are in a situation where you know that the sun will be shining and that you can generate power from that. And that has immense stability for an economy, whether it is a small village, whether it is the city of Santa Fe, or it is a statewide projection. In addition to that, you're not going to incur the costs of the disasters related to climate change, which has a huge economic benefit. So I feel like you do this because it is the right. We do this because it is the right thing. It is how you think clearly. But in addition to that, we do this because it makes economic sense to make good decisions.
What kinds of changes are you seeing in Minnesota as a result of climate change?
Well, most of the changes we've seen in Minnesota really have to do with more torrential storms, winds. I mean, the town of Wadena made the news a couple of months ago because it got flattened in a tornado. I mean, bad way to make the news, but that's what I'm looking at,
right,
is a lot of wind. You know, and I just rebuilt a house after a fire, and I rebuilt it for climate change. I'm praying hard that things are okay because you cannot really predict. But, you know, I considered where I put my solar panels. I consider what kind of roof system I use because the winds are getting more significant where I live. And, you know, I'm doing the best I can, but I had an opportunity to make a house that was a little bit stronger than the house I had before. And so I did that. But not most people don't have that opportunity. There's a lot of people on my reservation and in northern Minnesota that are living in trailers, and they're flipping the first big wind that comes through. So, you know, that's what we're seeing. Drought, some more hailstorms, earlier frosts. And so, you know, what we are doing is trying to put up more wind turbines. I'm fighting to get online here on the power lines. And we're also growing more local food, and we're growing heritage varieties that are not genetically engineered, because a lot of these really old varieties are pre-industrial agriculture, pre-irrigation, and they're more frost-resistant. So I refer to them as you know, having a better shot in the time of climate change.
What are some of the ways in which Native American traditions can show a different path than the one that we're taking?
Well, you know, I don't have all those answers. You know, but what I would say is that if you're asking for more of a spiritual analysis of this, there is a different worldview. There are many complex worldviews. I was trained as an economist. I went to Harvard, and I spent time at MIT in graduate school. I am fully aware and painfully aware of the economic model that permeates American culture. And I'm also painfully aware of the impact of that model on Indian communities or on other communities who have been mined, irradiated, groundwater contamination throughout New Mexico or elsewhere in the world. The diseconomies of this analysis are not considered and run roughshod over long-term stability in any means. A durable, you know, if that's what we would call it, a durable approach to an economy is a holistic view that says, first, let us look here and figure out how to live peacefully. So, for instance, our word, Ndinaway Muganatuk, we are all related, which means that our relatives may have fins or wings or roots or hooves. And it is our responsibility to be careful, mindful, and respectful of all of those relatives and not view them only as natural resources which are managed, cultivated, harvested, and destroyed. That's a very different paradigm of valuing life. you know, which I always, not to be how you call it, but, you know, I always hear about the pro-life forces. I'm like, well, what about all these relatives? Are we not pro their life also?
Right.
Then you look at, you could bring further, like, who has the right to transform that life form? You know, in our teachings, we don't have that right. We have the right to be respectful. And if you're respectful, you'll have a good life. Minoba Mata Ziwin, a good life. If you are respectful, kind, thoughtful, you know, and you are doing the right thing. Then, you know, the next step from that is in a lot of our traditions, there is far more value associated with giving than in accumulating. And that is one of the problems we are facing. In this American society and American paradigm, we are faced with the idea that accumulation and aggrandizement of wealth, you know, accumulating it, wealth and power, is associated with those two things. In a native spiritual tradition, the stature is associated with the giving of yourself, the giving of all you can from, you know, in giveaways. You see that traditionally in a lot of our cultural practices. That's what your stature is associated with, not with taking, but with giving. And then, you know, you look at the long term. You're interviewing me from New Mexico. Those guys have been down there for 8,000, 10,000 years. They seem to have a pretty good hang on how to live down there. You know, it might be a good thing to note for a city like Albuquerque, which does not seem to have a plan. I mean, not to cast aspersions, but just to say, look, try to figure out how to live within your means, because that would be a better plan over the long term.
We're talking to Native American activist, environmentalist, and economist Winona LaDuke. One of the things that what you're saying, I think, points up very strongly is that when you get overly into accumulation, you also create so much waste, and that waste is part of the climate change problem.
Yeah, I mean, you got waste heat to start with in climate change. You know, so, and you've got the fact that it's estimated that at least a half to two-thirds of the power that from the point of origin to the point of use from centralized power production is squandered and wasted. And that, you know, it's like fishing. You know, you could use an analogy of bycatch in factory trawlers, where two-thirds of the fish is thrown back into the ocean dead as a doorknob before it ends up at Long John Silver's or at Red Lobster. And that bycatch, all of that is even, you know, is incredibly destructive to the ecosystem and is destructive to life forms. So why would we want to continue in the state of New Mexico or elsewhere, continue to capitalize an inefficient energy economy when we could, one, be more efficient across the board, two, build housing that doesn't require such a massive amount of air conditioning, three, consider our whole workforce strategy on when people work and when they don't work and, you know, how this is and how much transporting they do. Four, you look at efficiency in everything from our appliances to our household choices. Five, create local power systems where every house in the Southwest is powered by solar. You know, this guy, David Melton, not to pitch him, but, you know, over there, Sacred Power, they're doing solar for the military, and they're over there in Albuquerque. These guys have the capacity to do solar power across the board. There's, you know, native and non-native contractors that could save the state of New Mexico billions of dollars and save them the cost of putting up new bad power plants. So it's endless, the situation that we're in and the opportunity to get out of it. But it's a shame that we live in a country where, you know, you look at some place like Spain, and I believe about half the power in Spain comes from wind energy. I'm not sure. But there's many countries in Europe that are just far advanced. And we, you know, in New Mexico has the potential to produce its entire energy economy largely from solar and wind. And there is no reason to not be the leader in that, because that's where economic stability comes from.
A lot of politicians talk about the importance of doing something about climate change, and they often use the term, Bill McKibben points this out in some of his writings, for the sake of their grandchildren. Can you talk about the gap between what politicians say and what they do in terms of climate change?
Well, one of the things that I notice is that you know, in the time of climate change, what I've noticed is that a lot of politicians are interested in what's going to happen on their watch. So these guys will be on in 4 years. And so they are thinking, well, it's not going to happen on my watch. I mean, I heard this. I actually heard this talking to a tribal government. That's not going to happen on my watch, so why am I worried about it? That approach is the challenge. In indigenous traditions, for instance, the Iroquois Confederacy, the appointment of chiefs was a process. It was called condolence, condoling of chiefs. That process was undertaken by the clan mothers. The leaders of their community, the clan mothers, would appoint or condole a chief, and they had the power to remove a chief, which is interesting because the founding fathers followed a democracy system of the Iroquois Confederacy because they had no experience with democracy, but the Six Nations are the longest-standing democracy on the continent and one of the longest-standing in the world. Anyway, they call it condoling for a reason, because you take, as a leader, the responsibility for your people. And so the greatness of the weight is why they are condoled into that responsibility. And that, I think, is something that, you know, it is a great weight that politicians have, but I think that far too often the significance spiritually of doing the right thing intergenerationally at the moment that they are in is lost. So I encourage leaders, political leaders in the state of New Mexico and elsewhere, to recognize this moment we are in. Now is the time to address climate change. New Mexico is one of the most egregious states in the country. New Mexico, Arizona, Wyoming, Montana. There you go. That's some pretty big combustors out there. And those states have the opportunity to provide some leadership and follow and even set a higher bar than California, and create a new energy economy that will catapult the state into a leadership on climate change, and more than that, transform the economy from one that is fossil fuel dependent and full of the vagaries of a fossil fuel economy into a long-term self-reliant economy.
Tell us about some of the clean energy and diverse energy initiatives that you've seen in Native communities.
Okay, well, you know, when we began talking, I was trying to get the keys to the door to the wind turbine.
Right.
We put up a wind turbine here on the White Earth Reservation that's a 75-kilowatt lowland wind turbine. And that turbine is to power this facility that I am in. And I am still battling the power company to get online and to hook the whole system up. But what I would tell you is that this is a model of both the potential and the challenges faced by rural communities in generating community-controlled power. So we are working on this here on our reservation. The Rosebud Tribe in South Dakota has a 750-kilowatt wind turbine up. The Shakopee Mittewakanton, Dakota, has a 1.5-megawatt wind turbine that powers their reservation and is looking to expand to more wind turbines in the next couple of years. They also have a biodiesel facility, I think, using biodiesel from the waste oil from their tribal casino. They have a gray water system, an apiary. Is that where bees are kept?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's what it is, apiary. Yeah. And greenhouses. You know, just more innovation. And I'm telling you something of that scale because I know that there are tribal casinos in New Mexico, but I also know that there are facilities of that scale that have the potential to run entirely on solar or to be more efficient. Personally, my personal suggestion has always been that they should go back to kind of old school in gaming where you pull the crank to get your money. I'm not much of a gambler, but pull the crank to try to get your money after you put your quarter in. And if you could have the cranks power the building,
right,
you know, if you're following what I'm saying,
right,
then they probably would make a lot of money, and that whole process of energy production, I'm sure, would be awesome. You know, similar for every one time they have one of those darn gyms, and you go in there to the gym to work out, and they have all these electric machines. I'm like, why are they not powering the building off of the treadmills?
Exactly, and the stationary bicycles.
Yeah, there's, you know, a lot of opportunities. So let's just be more innovative. You know, I did have one of those to power my kids' TV before. They were going to get pretty svelte on it, but yeah.
We're talking to Winona LaDuke. So you are here testifying on behalf of the carbon cap in New Mexico. And I guess the idea is that New Mexico provides leadership so that other states will get inspired to do the same thing.
I am hoping. That is what I'm hoping.
Yeah.
That New Mexico provides leadership so but other states can do the same thing.
Tell us about your organization, Honor the Earth.
So Honor the Earth works, I work for two organizations, really. So I'm at the offices of the White Earth Land Recovery Project right now, which is like a community-based community development organization that works on local food and local energy economies on the White Earth Reservation. And I say that always because, you know, the work I do nationally at Honor the Earth is predicated and based on strategy that comes from a community. We didn't spin straw into gold and spin ideas out of anywhere, you know, and just all theory. I understand what it is like to work in a rural community on the issues of fuel poverty, where you cannot pay your fuel bill, food security, where you cannot get enough good food to eat, and a third of your people have diabetes, and energy sovereignty. You know, I understand what it is in these ideas. So I do this here, and then I work nationally with Honor the Earth, which is on behalf of whom I'm testifying at the hearing, which I believe is next week.
Right.
And in that, the Environmental Improvement Board. And in that, my experience is that I'm working in these communities that are already heavily afflicted by climate change, or I'm working in communities like we are supporting this work up in northern Alberta to stop the tar sands expansion, which is the dirtiest oil you could have in terms of its impact on the environment. And, you know, you see these communities that are very, very, very impacted disproportionately, environmental justice issues, but issues of technological choice and greed by corporations. And there is something that is incredibly, it is unjust. And at this point, we have the ability to do the right thing. And so, you know, I'm coming to New Mexico to say what happens in New Mexico matters to the rest of us. I have worked in New Mexico off and on for the past, first time I worked there was 1979, in the bottom of the Anaconda uranium mine at Laguna Pueblo. Testimony, hearings, I'm familiar with the energy economy of the state of New Mexico since 1979, when I was down there at the age of 20. And I see New Mexico as a state that is poised in the place that we are in our prophecies, in this opportunity to make a choice between two worlds. One is well-worn and scorched. That's what the fossil fuel nuclear economy looks like. And one is not well-worn and it's green. And that's what a solar, wind, local food, local energy, efficient economy looks like. And the second, over the long term, is going to be healthy.
Winona LaDuke, thanks so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Yeah, thanks for having me very much. And really the best to you down there, and I hope that you all have a good day.
Thank you, and we'll see you here in New Mexico.
Yeah, thank you. Miigwech.
We've been talking to Winona LaDuke. She is a Native American activist, economist, environmentalist, and writer. She's the executive director of the organizations Honor the Earth and White Earth Land Recovery Project. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks so much to Sean Conlon for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.